This past Saturday, a couple of spelunkers were rescued from a cave at Maquoketa Cave State Park. One had been trapped for more than 20 hours. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll hear about the dramatic rescue of the two cavers from Robert Edwards of the Maquoketa Fire Department's rescue squad. Before that, in light of a weekend boating tragedy on the Mississippi that cost four lives, we'll talk boating safety with Susan Stocker of the DNR. Also, volunteer diver Scott Hofstetter with the Linn County Underwater Search and Rescue Team will tell us about the hazards of searching for presumed drowning victims. All coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In light of a weekend boating tragedy on the Mississippi that cost four lives, and as we prepare for Memorial Day weekend, traditionally a big weekend on the water, we want to spend the first part of the show talking about water and boating safety. Authorities now say the late-night Mississippi River boat crash that left four people dead was a near head-on collision of two small fishing boats that were shuttling partiers to shore. The Des Moines County Sheriff says those involved had been partying on an island in the Mississippi, and the boats were shuttling people to a boat dock around 2 a.m. on Saturday. One newer boat had dropped off people and was returning for more when it hit an older boat with 11 passengers. The 11 were thrown into the water. All but four were pulled from the water and taken to shore in the newer boat. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources says the four bodies were found Sunday within 100 yards of the crash site. Officials say no one was wearing a life vest, and they're still sorting out the cause of this tragedy. Joining us now, Susan Stocker, boating safety coordinator for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources in our Des Moines studio. Susan, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Of course, heartsick about this most recent tragedy. Can you add any information to that I just relayed from the Associated Press?
Ben, I can't. As you'd said, the investigation is still ongoing, so I'm unable to add anything to that.
Of course, we have the information, no life jackets for any of the passengers, and we know from statistics that that could have saved, very well have saved lives.
It is. Nationally, we know that approximately 90% of the individuals that find themselves in the water, unfortunately, end up drowning because they don't have life jackets on.
Mm-hmm. What does our law say about life jackets and wearing life jackets?
Life jackets are required, a wearable life jacket on board the vessel for every passenger that is in the boat. And then Iowa has recently enacted a law that requires any young person 12 and under is required to wear a life jacket while the boat is underway.
Okay, older than 12, though, one life jacket, one life preserver per person, but not wearing that, right?
That is correct. And we would certainly like to encourage everyone to be wearing the life jackets.
Is that any different than neighboring states? Do other states have, for instance, a mandatory wearing of a life jacket?
The different states across the nation have age differences in Iowa, but pretty much all of the states except one do require a mandatory life jacket for at least youth.
Mm-hmm. I understand life jackets, people regard them as a minor nuisance. They're often bulky, but there are some newer ones that are not quite as problematic, are they?
There are, and the U.S. Coast Guard has made some great strides to make life jackets more comfortable, lightweight, and so on the market you can find a life jacket that's referred to as an inflatable, and there are different models, and they're comfortable, and so to encourage people to wear them.
Okay. I'm wondering about, let's first talk about the new blood alcohol law that went into effect last July. Would you explain what changed?
Sure. The blood alcohol content, or the BAC level, changed, and it went from a 0.10 down to a 0.08. So it now mirrors the blood alcohol content for a motor vehicle.
Mm-hmm. It's been a short time, less than a year. Have you at the DNR, anyone noticed any difference on behavior on the water due to that law?
We did notice that the public was more aware of it after our marketing campaign and encouraged people to realize what the levels were. But we did see an increase in the number of arrests, and in 2011 we had 54 BWI arrests.
Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate that it will take some time before this sinks in, that there is this new blood alcohol law?
I think what will take some time is for people to understand that when they're out on the water, the effects of the wind and the glare and the sun off of the water actually enhances the effects of the alcohol.
What about enforcement, whether it be for alcohol, blood alcohol level, or wearing a life jacket, having a life jacket on board? Of course, lots of budget cuts across state budgets. Do you have the people to enforce this?
We certainly do, Ben. Our full-time officers will be patrolling the waterways, and we also have our seasonal water patrol that are a force multiplier to our full-time officers. And just to give you an idea, in 2011, we had over 32,000 hours provided from our officers for navigating on the water.
Mm-hmm. What's likely to happen if, say, you are caught without a life preserver?
Well, it can certainly give you or be issued a fine from the department, and then chances are you will have to end your day prematurely, because we certainly don't want to have people out there without having the proper safety equipment and finding themselves in trouble.
Mm-hmm. What about enforcement of the blood alcohol level? Is that similar to pulling over a car on the highway? You would notice or someone would notice some behavior and check it out and be able to pull over a boat?
You certainly, our officers are trained and certainly do notice when a boat operator is violating some rules and the laws, and so that would bring them cause in order to stop the boat, and then at that same time be able to do a boating safety check to make sure that the operator and has all the safety equipment required.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, in general, what type of activities are most likely to lead to an accident when we're boating?
What we encounter is a lot of speed and distance. So unlike on the road, we do not have a speed limit sign on the main channel of the water. We don't have the highway markers. And so what we encounter is boats traveling too close to each other at speeds higher than allowed.
Mm-hmm. What type of, unlike cars, you don't really need a license to operate a power boat, do you?
You do not, and we encourage everyone to take a boating safety course in order to learn the rules in the road and for boating, and also for anyone 12 to 17, they are required to take a boating safety course. And I'd certainly like to encourage everyone to take one, because even though you may have been boating for your whole life, mm-hmm. there are a lot of new boaters out there that maybe aren't as experienced, so I'd like to request that we're all more proactive than reactive.
Yeah, it's second nature for us to think that if you want to learn to drive a car, you will need to take some driver's education on the road. But we grow up a little bit differently when we approach boats, or when we think of boats, we tend to, even though actually it shouldn't be thought of that much differently, should it?
Exactly. You know, a boat is a very large piece of equipment, and as we know, there aren't any brakes on a boat, so it and the challenges makes it more difficult.
I wonder, can you provide any statistics that speak to the number and the nature of boating accidents in a typical year?
Sure. Last year in 2011, we ended up having 38 boating accidents. And of those 38, unfortunately, we had 4 fatalities, 24 injuries, and then we had over $150,000 worth of property damage.
Mm-hmm. So with these 4 fatalities we've had in the Mississippi here just this last weekend, we are at the number of fatalities for all of 2011.
We are, unfortunately.
Mm. Can you think of changes that you could point to that would have the biggest impact on boating safety in our state?
I truly think that the individuals, everyone wearing a life jacket and certainly taking a boating safety course. Again, the boating safety course will provide many, many tips and information in order to what to do in when you're out there boating.
Mm-hmm. Well, where can people find out about a boating safety course?
You can certainly go to our webpage at www.iowadnr.gov, and we have some online courses and some different opportunities that you can take.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned tips in these boating safety courses. You've mentioned, of course, a number. Of course, a lot of emphasis on life jackets, considering the tragedy that happened in the Mississippi. But what are some other tips you can give us for boaters listening?
Well, certainly the safety equipment that's required. Everyone should have a fire extinguisher on board if they're operating a boat with a motor greater than 10 horsepower. And having a horn or whistle on board, so if you find yourself in problems that you can signal to other individuals. And then, of course, the other thing is having a Type 4 throwable device, which is used if someone finds himself in the water so that a boat operator or help can toss that life jacket into the water for them.
Mm-hmm. If there's an accident, somebody ends up in the water, how often is it the case that people may just overestimate their abilities once they get into a water, especially water with a current?
People do that very often, and I hear that a lot when teaching classes, that people don't wear life jackets because they know how to swim. And so, you know, they don't realize that the current will take them down shore, and or if you're in the middle of a lake and you find yourself injured, where are you going to swim to?
Mm-hmm. We talked about alcohol a little bit earlier. How often is alcohol a contributing factor to an accident?
Usually, regarding the 2011 incidents that we had, 7 out of the 38 incidents reported alcohol was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, with our fatalities, on average, over 50% of our fatalities that occur with boating incidents involve alcohol.
Mm-hmm. How does Iowa differ than other Midwest states in terms of the regulations and restrictions on recreational boating? Quickly, we have just a few seconds.
Iowa is very, very similar to neighboring states and nationwide. We follow what the Coast Guard requires.
Okay. So are neighboring states to the north and south that much different than us?
No. Very, very similar to our the blood alcohol content is 0.08. Wearable life jackets are very, very similar. And all of the safety equipment that I mentioned are part of Coast Guard requirements. So we all follow those.
Okay. Boating Safety Coordinator for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, Susan Stocker, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thank you, Ben.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'm joined now by Scott Hofstetter. He's a volunteer diver with the Linn County Underwater Search and Rescue Team. He's also a Marion on-call firefighter and a systems engineer at Rockwell Collins. Scott, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
Scott Hofstetter, I understand you were involved in the search for a man believed to have drowned this weekend while trying to cross the Cedar River in the Cedar Rapids area. I know you can't talk about everything having to do with it, but what can you tell us about your involvement?
We received a request through the Cedar Rapids Police Department. I responded Saturday evening and got a size up of the situation, made arrangements at that point to contact other team members, and we set up to begin searching on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us if a body has been found?
I cannot comment on that, I guess.
Okay. When you say you sized up the situation, what does that mean for you as a diver?
Well, initially we received the information made us believe that the person may be caught near the what is called a roller dam or low head dam, and because of the dangers of that, that would be a no dive situation. We would have refused that call, being that the location where he possibly went down was further downstream. We look at basically where you possibly would be located at, what equipment we would, might need, and the number of people to support that search.
Mm-hmm. Now, parts of the Cedar River are shallow, this can be deceiving, can it? You are thoroughly acquainted, I'm sure, with the dangers that rivers present underneath their surface. Tell us about how deceiving that can be.
Some of these rivers have sandy bottoms, and when you get debris, like from maybe trees that have moved down the river, holes can develop behind them. There's also a lot of debris that gets dumped in there, either people just disposing of trash, or sometimes it's meant to help control erosion. The water is actually a little bit lower than typical, I'd say, right now, but the force of the water moving can create quite a force on your body, and even like 12 inches of water can hold a person in place if they, for instance, get their foot caught. It can be very difficult to get free.
Mm-hmm. So even while you can see the other bank, you might think, oh, I can cross that. It appears I can wade up to my knees or even to my waist. That's dangerous.
Yes, I mean, you could walk out to a certain point, and then the sand could give away, and depending, it's hard to see where the natural current, the stronger current is flowing through the river. So it could be kind of slow moving, and then all of a sudden be very strong and take you away.
How many of these types of operations have you been involved in search for someone believed to have been drowned?
As a diver, maybe less than a dozen. I'm also a canine handler who, probably dating back about 15 years, have been looking for victims with my with a dog, try to aid the divers in locating the victim.
Mm-hmm. When there is a suspected drowning, where are you looking for a body? What happens to a body after drowning?
Probably the places that we tend to find them the most would be caught up underneath submerged trees, or we call straining devices, things that can't be seen but create kind of an undertow mm-hmm. in those areas, and they tend to get trapped up under there.
Tell us a little bit about the Linn County Underwater Search and Rescue Team, of which you're a part of.
Teams made up of volunteers. We come from various backgrounds, career backgrounds. We've all started out as recreational divers. I guess are very passionate about diving, and then you can progress up from the basic open water certificate into more advanced levels. And then if you are interested in becoming a member, then we take you through some additional training in terms of search patterns and how to rescue a diver who may be in distress and need assistance underwater.
Mm-hmm. So aside from the situation we're talking about now, what other situations are you commonly called out for?
We typically get called out for cars that have been gone in the river either by accident or maybe they're being dumped because they're being stolen. It could be looking for a weapon that might have been involved in a crime. We've been asked by people who have lost their snowmobiles going across ice to assist in recovering those as well.
Scott, tell us a little bit more about how you work when you're searching for something in the river, a presumed drowning victim, for instance.
Typically, be in the rivers where you don't have a very good last seen point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get conflicting points of reference. And then it's just dealing with the current. And there's times where you would have to probably literally pull yourself along the bottom, trying to move because the current is so strong. The way we operate typically is we'll have one diver in the water tied to a rope, and we work from a boat that we'd anchor in the river. And we do search patterns back and forth, kind of an arcing pattern. He'll go to one extreme, and then we'll let out a length of rope depending on what we're looking for and how much overlap we need to deal with. And then that send them back the other way, back and forth. But the depth can be tricky, too. We've had divers when it gets real deep, and those snags where they could get forced underneath that and have difficulty getting back out.
Mm-hmm. So there have been situations when you or a member of your team have been in potentially life-threatening situations.
Yes.
So in Iowa's waterways, for you as an underwater search and rescue team member, it sounds like the biggest challenges are murky water and strong currents.
Yes. You get below probably maybe 10 feet, and it's just total darkness. You can't see anything at all, so you're totally going by the feeling around for what you're looking for.
So it's just your hands, I presume, in a glove, and you're just searching the sandy or muddy bottom feeling.
Yes, generally it's pretty silty. There's also, you can run into rusty old barrels to concrete and re-rod, so we risk damaging our equipment, injuring ourselves, the current pushing us into something that could be sharper and pale us. I've been tempted to start wearing a helmet underneath there just because things you could run into.
Sounds like very, very dangerous work.
I know there are divers who have died doing, generally this is referred to as public safety diving, in that kind of a classification. So,
Scott, what draws you to it? What appeals to you about this type of work, as dangerous as it can be?
I just felt I could contribute. I've been a paid on-call firefighter for almost 30 years, and I thought I'd just kind of fit in. Like I said, I've been also a canine handler and help locating potential sites for the divers to work.
How do the dogs fit into this underwater search and rescue team?
The scent from the victim will rise to the surface, and then the winds will pick that up, and the dog can detect that. And so we'll generally put the dog in a boat and work a search pattern, trying to narrow down the search area. Unfortunately, it's not like a dog searching on land can easily pick up the direction for the strongest scent and work in towards where the victim is. But in the water, it's a communication issue between the dog, the handler, and the boat driver, and trying to figure out what is going on. The wind currents can be very deceiving in which way the direction that the scent is being drawn to the boat. For instance, like this weekend, we had a south wind, but we get on the river, it turns more north. And then you have issues like tree lines and embankments. They stir the air up and create eddies. And so it's kind of a puzzle trying to put things together. You try to build a search pattern, and all we can do is give them a rough idea of what we think is happening and give them the best opportunity to locate the victim.
Scott Hofstetter, a volunteer diver with the Linn County Underwater Search and Rescue Team. Thank you very much for telling us a little bit about what you do.
Thank you.
This past Saturday, a couple of spelunkers were rescued from a cave at Maquoketa Cave State Park, one of them being trapped for more than 20 hours. When we come back, we'll hear about the dramatic rescue of the two cavers. Also, Scott Dykstra of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. He's a park ranger at Maquoketa Cave State Park. He'll tell us about the reopening of the caves after them being closed for 2 years. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This past Saturday, a couple of spelunkers had to be rescued from a cave at Maquoketa Caves State Park. One of them, the man, had been trapped for more than 20 hours. Joining us now to talk about it, Robert Edwards. He is a Maquoketa firefighter and a member of the Maquoketa Fire Department's Rescue Squad. Robert Edwards was one of the first rescuers on the scene. And thank you for joining us, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
I understand the ordeal began for these two young people about 7 p.m. on Friday evening when 20-year-old Logan Eliason, along with his friend Emma Thompson, she's 20, both of Port Byron, Illinois, entered the cave. What can you tell us about what happened after that?
Well, we got called out roughly around 8:30 to go out for this. And we wasn't exactly for sure what was going to detail of this. Normally when we go out to the caves, it's more so we're picking somebody up out of a trail. They slept, fall, you know, broke a leg.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our calls were carrying people out, and we didn't have any idea that it was going to be this detailed of a mission, you could say.
Right. So you arrive, and what did you find? This is in one of the caves. Is it Y Cave?
That is correct. It's called the Y Cave, yes. Myself and another firefighter, we were the first two to go down into the cave to where these two were trapped to just kind of assess the situation to see what, you know, equipment we're going to need or try to get a game plan going.
Mm-hmm. Give us a little bit of the a picture of this, of the architecture of the cave. You say go down in the cave. So this is in a cliffside, and you actually enter how big of an entrance and then go down?
Well, I wouldn't actually say cliffside. You're more so on the ground, and you do about an 8 to 10 foot vertical drop straight down initially to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you just basically, you might crawl for a little bit, you could walk for a little bit, you're going to be on your stomach for a little bit crawling. It probably took us, I'm going to say, maybe about 15 minutes just to get back to where they were at.
So we're not talking about a tourist cave where we're walking in upright. We are on our belly doing an army crawl a lot of the time.
Oh, yes, yes. There were spots, yeah. That was the only way to get through, yes, was actually on your stomach or your back crawling. That is correct.
So from the entrance, how many feet away from the entrance were they?
I heard they were 300 feet away.
You crawled and maneuvered 300 feet into the cave before you found them. What did you find?
Well, initially, when we got there, we could not make physical contact, but we could physically see them and talk to them. And they were in really good spirits, which helped the situation out a lot.
Why couldn't you get up to contact with them?
There was a 90-degree turn that you had to take and to go down the small corridor about 15, 12 feet away before you could actually get to them. And that was the problem we were having, was with this 90-degree turn. We had to remove and chisel some rock away before we could actually get around that turn to access.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you made contact with them, voice contact. What were they saying?
Initially, when I went down there, you know, they were laughing and they were talking back and forth with each other. And once we told them who they were, I think they were pretty relieved to find out that somebody was there to help them out.
Right. I read in the account in the Quad City Times that the woman Emma had been suffering some panic attacks. Did that come later?
I don't think that was later. That might have been before we got there, because when we were speaking to them, like I said, she seemed okay. The situation she was laying in, I was more concerned about her legs not being able to use them, because she was kind of like on her stomachs and her legs was elevated above her. So that was my concern with her.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what did you do?
Well, as I said, we chipped out some rock. I did the initial chiseling, and after I kind of got tired from that, I wasn't able, I didn't want to crawl back there and become a part of the problem. So one of the other firefighters went back there and assessed the situation from there.
Okay, so there were two access points. So you, the man, Logan Eliason, was trapped behind her? She was sort of plugging the hole?
Yes, yeah. Where they were at, there was a small hole he had to crawl into. Yes, Logan went in first. Then once Emma got stuck, Logan was able to turn himself around. He was not trapped at this point. He turned himself around to try to help Emma out.
He was just plugged up in a bottle, so to
speak. Yes, yes. He had no way in or out, correct.
Okay. So your first task is to get Emma out. You chipped for a while, and how long did it take her to free her?
Well, it was, I guess, from the time we got on scene and from the time we got her out, I'm going to say it probably took us maybe roughly three hours.
Mm-hmm. What were the challenges while you were trying to free her that you were most concerned with?
It was a very confined space. I was just trying to use a regular handheld air chisel, and they're not very big to begin with. Just working in that 90-degree area and trying to maneuver this air chisel around, it was very difficult. And plus, there was no air movement, and then all the dirt and dust just limbered in the air.
Mm, for you, too. Were you wearing any oxygen?
No, there was no way I could wear any of our SCBAs or nothing, just due to the space I was working in.
Okay, so did you have to take frequent breaks?
I did. I would stop for a little bit, kind of let everything settle, talk to them, see how they were doing, and then I would continue again.
Mm-hmm. And once the drilling went, how was Emma faring?
She was doing pretty good yet, really. You know, like I said, after I got done chiseling, I backed out to let the other firefighter try to go back to her.
Mm-hmm. What was the hairiest part of this experience for you?
For me? Oh, boy. I was just concerned getting some of our personnel stuck back in there, because like I said, that 90-degree turn was just, it was very hard.
Had you ever been in this specific cave or before?
No, to be honest with you, I never knew it existed until then.
Uh-huh. Okay. So Emma is freed. Give me a picture of what happened then.
Well, I said the other firefighter went back, helped her get loose, and she had to crawl backwards out. And as they was crawling out backwards, I heard someone say, uh-oh. And I asked what happened, and that's when I heard it was, I think Logan's stuck.
So she had to crawl out backwards 300 feet, and was she injured at all?
No, she was not injured. She just had some scrapes and bruises, and
okay.
And really, she only had to crawl out backwards maybe a total of 20, 25 feet.
Okay, good. Okay, so now Logan is our problem. We hear, uh-oh, and what happened to Logan?
Well, after we got Emma free, because no one else could get in and out until she was cleared, after we got her out, the other firefighter, the one that got her out, went back in again since he was pretty well familiar with the situation, and he confirmed, yes, Logan was stuck at this time.
I wonder how that could be, because you chiseled that portion of the cave larger, enlarged it, and he'd gotten back there somehow, right?
Yes. From what I got, where he was standing at, it was kind of like a V-shaped crack. And I think, I don't know if his foot slipped, and when that happened, you know, basically where he was lodged, it was between his stomach and his hip area.
So he slipped and became wedged in this V-shaped part.
Yes, because all I could see of him initially was his head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he was like standing down below the opening.
Mm-hmm. And what was his emotional state? Was he talking much?
Yes, he was. We tried to keep as much voice contact as possible, you know, help keep keep them calm. They feel better knowing that someone's there talking to them.
Okay, so they entered the cave at about 7 p.m. Emma's freed, what is this, at 10 or 11 p.m. on Friday, right?
I would say around 11:30 is when she was out, yes.
Okay, so we have another 15, 17 hours to go before Logan. He's there the whole night and a lot of Saturday. So tell me, what's going on then?
By this time, we called a MABUS 43 group out of the Rock Island Arsenal to come up. You know, they're a little more technical and have more equipment than us. We pretty well exhausted all of our means trying to get Logan out at this point.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Robert Edwards, Maquoketa firefighter, also a member of the Maquoketa Fire Department's rescue squad. Robert was one of the first rescuers on the scene where a couple of spelunkers were trapped in a cave at Maquoketa Cave State Park, as we're hearing Logan, for more than 20 hours. I understand that Logan, at some point, there needed to be oxygen taken back there.
Yes. Initially, even when we was down there, we were so far down that we don't have the normal oxygen content as you do up here on the ground. Yes. Even we were working in low levels, but the enclosed compartment he was in was worse yet, yes.
Were people getting, rescuers getting lightheaded and so forth?
Yes, big concerns was headaches, which was due to lack of oxygen, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I don't think you were there at the moment Logan was freed, but what do you understand about how he was freed?
Well, initially, yeah, I was sent home at 4 o'clock in the morning. I came back later that afternoon, and he was still in the cave yet, but I did see, I believe it was the Iowa Task Force 1 out of Cedar Rapids. I seen them carry a jackhammer down there.
Mm, okay.
Yes, then I knew it got serious then.
Okay. But you returned in the afternoon. He was still in there. What time was he freed?
3:30.
3:30 in the afternoon. So 20 hours in that cave. Did you have a look or talk with him as he came out?
All I did was help. Once they got him out of the cave, I helped carry him up to the ambulance.
Mm-hmm. What kind of condition was he in?
He looked very exhausted and fatigued, yes.
Was he saying anything?
Mainly his dad came up and was talking to him for a little bit just to let him know everything was okay, and, you know, his parents were there.
Mm-hmm. Any visible injuries, apparent ones?
That I could not see, no.
Okay. He was checked out, and so we understand that they are both doing well at this point. As a member of the Maquoketa Fire Department's rescue squad, Robert, are you trained for such things?
Well, at least once or twice a year we try to get out the caves and train, but usually it's not inside the cave. Like I said, it's more so external, you know, people slipping off the cliffs, carrying people out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we do have people that take training outside of our department, you know, to try to take classes that would help with situations like this.
Classes in caving and spelunking?
They call it, like, closed confined space is what they call it. I don't think there's really, I've never seen any classes maybe that contain to stuff like this.
Mm-hmm. How are you with confined spaces?
Oh, I was fine down there. I mean, it don't bother me, really. It's just, the lack of oxygen thing, that's the only thing I'm concerned about, because I don't need to become part of the problem.
Right. Will you put this, chalk this up to one of your more unusual rescues?
Oh, yes. Yes, most definitely. even talking to some of the other departments that were there, we just talked to a guy from Davenport Fire, and he said this was a first for him.
Mm-hmm. As a part of the rescue squad, what do you find the most satisfying, most rewarding part of your work?
Just knowing that I actually, you know, was able to help somebody in a time of need.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if, with the caves back open, that's a good thing. If there are any words of wisdom as someone who's had to rescue a couple of people or help rescue a couple of people for those who might be going off to Maquoketa Caves for a little bit of an adventure, not quite the adventure that Logan and Emma
yes.
found themselves in.
All you ask, if you're questioning something about doing something, don't do it. Yeah.
If you look down a cave, you start going down there, and you get that feeling like, I might get stuck.
Yes. Yeah. Just go with your gut instinct and don't do it. Yes.
Okay. Robert Edwards, I want to thank you very much for telling about your experience in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Edwards is a Maquoketa firefighter and member of the Maquoketa Fire Department's Rescue Squad. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Maquoketa Cave State Park closed over 2 years ago. That was in May of 2010. It was just reopened. That was in April of this year. Joining us now to talk about it, Scott Dykstra. He's with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. He's a park ranger at the Maquoketa Caves State Park. Scott, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Remind us why it was closed in May of 2010.
The caves were closed to prevent the spread of white nose syndrome. It's a disease that affects bats during, well, not just during hibernation, but the fungus grows in the cave system. And that's when the bats get sick, is while they're hibernating in that close quarters.
Now, were any of the Maquoketa caves infected with this white nose syndrome?
To our knowledge, no. We do not have the disease. We're still trying to prevent it from getting it. We do have some Q-tip swabs that we did when we surveyed the bats that we sent in to a laboratory, and we have not gotten those results back. But the visual inspection that we did showed no signs of it. So we feel pretty confident we don't have it, but, of course, we don't have the laboratory results back yet.
So the thought was, when you closed it, that people would be bringing in this fungus to infect the caves.
Yeah, it's more than likely this disease is being spread from bat to bat. It's a higher percentage of that happening. But there is a small percentage that somebody could inadvertently go to a place that has this fungus that's growing in the caves that causes white nose syndrome, and it may, you know, be in the tread of their boot or a spore on their backpack or something like that that they would bring here and go explore our caves, and that would accidentally fall off the boot or wherever it is, mm-hmm. and deposit in our caves and start growing, and then it would affect our bats that we have that hibernate here at the park.
So why do you feel at the DNR that this is no longer a threat?
It's still a threat, but we feel that we can hopefully control the spread of this disease through education. So with the reopening of the park this year, everybody has to go through an education awareness program before they can actually explore our caves. And it's a short 5-10 minute little program, more or less, as we talk about the disease and or the fungus and the prevention of it. And not only that, we also talk about the importance of our bats for an ecosystem, why they serve such an intricate role into an ecosystem, and the easy measures we can take to prevent the spread. It's a simple little thing of making sure we properly disinfect our boots or clothes, any caving gear that you may have, before going to the next place that you're going to explore, just so you don't accidentally spread this fungus that causes this disease.
So does the Maquoketa Cave State Park now have any sort of a station where you disinfect your boots, or are you left to yourself to get that done?
You're left to yourself. What we do is we'll explain the education part of it, and then we ask the people that are at the education place usually three simple questions. If they pass the first question, of course, they get their wristband and they go play. And, you know, the first question is we're trying to make sure no one has explored a cave system or a mine in the past 6 years east of the Mississippi River or in the state of Missouri, because those are the areas that have been confirmed of having white nose syndrome. If they have not been in any of those areas, they will get a wristband. They can explore our park. If they have been in an area, we make sure that they aren't wearing the same clothes or the same boots or gear or anything, you know, they may have on them was not in those cave systems. If they say, no, we have totally different clothes and boots and all that stuff, they will be given a wristband. If they say, oh, I got the same backpack, you know, we'll say, okay, you know, you need to leave the backpack in the vehicle, and then they'll be able to go explore the caves. Or if it's say, oh, I'm wearing the same boots or I have the same knee pads or shirt or whatever on, we'll ask them to either go home, change their clothes, or go to town and get something different, or buy some stuff to disinfect it. The two things that work for disinfection is a water and bleach solution will help kill off any fungus or spore. There's also a Lysol solution that's antifungal that also kills that stuff. We ask them to go and do all that stuff, and then they can come back and explore our caves.
Mm-hmm. Now, to be clear, this fungal disease, white nose syndrome, is not dangerous to humans.
No. It, to our knowledge, it has no impact on humans unless, you know, somebody that may have allergies to some stuff. You know, those are the only things I'm aware of, but it's just, to our knowledge, it just affects our bats.
What has been the impact on bats?
Well, I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but there's been a drastic decrease in bat populations on the east. You know, like New York, that's where it was first founded in 2006. They estimated, good Lord, I think it was 2 million or 2 billion pounds of insects that aren't being eaten by bats.
Is that the primary value of bats in our ecosystem, is that they get rid of a lot of the insects?
Yeah, they get a lot of insects. They eat a lot of insects, excuse me. You know, they say a single bat can eat anywhere from 5 to 10 times their body weight in night insects alone. And not only that, in some areas, you know, the bats serve as a role of a pollination or things like that, so it really affects a lot of agricultural-type stuff also.
Mm-hmm. How has the closure of the caves over the past 2 years affected the number of visitors coming to Maquoketa Cave State Park?
We've seen a drastic decrease in our park visitors. You know, we roughly figured that we saw close to 250,000 people during the rec season. That dropped down to maybe 40,000 to 80,000 people in a rec season. And I will say, with the caves being reopened, I have seen a great increase in park usage again.
Mm-hmm. What do you think will be the fallout for your park visitation from this ordeal that we're hearing about from the past weekend, two young people having to be rescued from a cave?
You know, I don't think it'll actually I don't think it'll hurt us at all. I actually think we'll probably get more people out there just because, you know, as humans, we're all so curious about what happened and would like to go see the area that it did happen. You know, it was one of those fluke accidents that, you know, I can't say that it ain't going to happen again, but the odds are it probably won't. Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking to a park employee or my supervisor about it, and, he said, you know, from his knowledge, when the park has been opened up, or back in, I don't know how many years ago that was, there's only been two instances like this that someone has gotten stuck in our cave system.
So likely to all the media attention will bring more people to the caves rather than scare them away.
I think so. I think you know, if they didn't catch the earlier press or media that we had that the caves were reopened, this is another chance that the publicers are being aware that the caves did get reopened this summer and confirmed that people are capable of exploring our caves.
Scott Dykstra is with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. He's a park ranger at the Maquoketa Caves State Park. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.